Hello and welcome to another episode of the CG Garage. This is episode number 469, which is going to be a recap episode, or actually more of a flashback episode. Yes, I think I mentioned the last intro I did that I've been super, super busy on a project, and it's going to be harder for me to record some new podcasts as we go, which I'm going to get to in a bit. So we decided instead we were going to do these flashback episodes, and this was Henry's idea, and I think is great. And we are going to go back to episode number 284, which was in July 2020, and we're going to do part of that podcast, and that was with Doug Trumbull. Unfortunately, Doug has since passed away, but he is a legendary person, obviously, in the world of filmmaking, as well as, obviously, the world of visual effects. He did the visual effects for the movie 2001 and Close Encounters and a bunch of other things, but he is also sort of revolutionizing new types of formats of viewing formats and projection formats that he was trying to do, including his Magi system. And we get into depth about that. Incredible person to talk to, and really an amazing person that I had the very lucky to be involved with and on a project for Construct, as well as just being able to know who he was, and really incredible person. And we decided to pair that with another great episode that we did in December 2016. And that was our 100th episode with Tim Miller and Joe Kaczynski. And we did that live at Noman, which was absolutely incredible. And Tim Miller, as you guys might know, was director of Deadpool, as well as several other things. He did the last Terminator film and is working on some really great projects. He also happens to be one of the founder of Blur. And Joe Kaczynski, I've known him for many years. I've worked on a couple of his movies, including Tron and Oblivion. But he's also the director of Top Gun Maverick and is a really, really amazing and super, super nice guy. That was a sort of a combined podcast we did for the 100th episode. And the cool thing about that specific episode, looking back now, obviously, is that was really one of the ones that really helped the podcast itself blow up. Tim has been great. He's actually been on the podcast several times, but this was the one episode he decided he was going to let people know about some of the things that led to his reasons for departing on Deadpool 2, and sort of got into the news, and we were able to talk about that. So really cool that he was able to do that. Tim's a really nice guy. And anyway, it was good to go back and sort of remember those days back in 2016, which is so long ago. It was 8 years ago. I can't believe that. So really cool that we're doing that. So why are we doing these recap episodes? Like I said, I have been super, super busy. There is a new project that I'm involved with called Project Arena, and it is part of the Chaos Innovation Labs. As you guys probably know, I am the director of special projects at the Chaos Innovation Labs, and I've been involved in Project Arena for a very long time. It's something that I've been passionate about. And I can finally start talking about it a little bit more, because there's been an article that we've been waiting to come out, that came out in Variety, and you'll probably see it by the time this podcast comes out, which it talks a little bit about what we're doing. It is a very ambitious project. It's about virtual production. It's about real-time ray tracing. It's about Vantage, and basically how we're bringing Vantage to a virtual production experience, and something I've been passionate about since Construct, which I talk about a little bit with Doug on this particular episode. So very exciting. I'm sure you guys can check it out. Just go to chaos.com and learn more about Project Arena, or just look up the Variety article if you'd like to do that as well. Okay, a couple of other big product announcements I want to do. I want to make sure you guys know about V-Ray 6 Update 2 in Maya and Houdini. And the big thing for that is that we've added big support for Material X. If you want to know more about that, actually just go to the previous episode, episode number 468, where we talk to Alex and Gosho about that particular update and what's going on there. Another thing I want to mention is that in terms of events is that we will be at FMX and we will be able to talk to you guys. I will not be at FMX, unfortunately, but a lot of Chaos people will be. And so that is happening April 22nd through the 25th. And that's going to, of course, happen in Stuttgart, Germany. And it'll be people there. And if you want to know more about Project Arena, I'm sure people would be happy to tell you more about that, or how you would like to get involved in Project Arena, which is also happening as well. But for now, you go back to 2020 with Doug Trumbull, and go back to 2016 with Tim Miller and Joe Kaczynski.
Welcome to another CG Garage, where the Chaos Group talks. You'll know it's over when the last bucket drops. We're gonna fire off rays in high dynamic range. We know that ambient occlusion is passé. Global illumination won't lead you astray. And while image-based lighting is really swell, you need to make sure everything has Fresnel.
I remember when you showed, there was something that was really interesting that really sort of, the one thing when I saw it that really resonated. And I went to the screening at Photochem, the first time I saw the construct at the Maji Specs. But there was you had done your own short, which was Infotog? Is that what it was?
Infotog,
right?
Yeah.
And there was it was great. But the thing that really sort of like made me go, oh, like it was really amazing, was we had a shot where you were looking at the and it was really like looking into a window. It was no longer looking at film,
right.
Or a flick, as you said before, right?
Right.
And so you were looking through a window and you saw the characters moving through it. And in the window, there was a TV screen that was playing at 24 frames a second.
Yeah.
And you realized you created the contrast within the same frame to show you this is what 24 looks like and this is what I'm looking at 120. And I was like, oh. And of course, if you do the math, you can do it, because basically all you're redoing is 24 frames a second inside of the 120, right? You're just showing the image five times and it makes sense. So it totally resonated for me for that time. And you know, when I was a teenager, one of my favorite films was actually Brainstorm, and I love that film.
Okay.
In fact, I have another podcast I do where it's me and two of my friends, and we're big film geeks, and we did a whole episode just on Brainstorm. We talked about it for 3 hours. And
I'd love to see that.
Oh, I'll definitely send it to you. But the thing that was interesting to me, and that we realized when we were researching it, is that Brainstorm had those two states of film in there, right? You had when you were in the Brainstorm world, everything was done at 60 frames, right?
It was not. That was my plan, but I couldn't get the studio to do it.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So the only thing I was allowed, that movie was designed for the show scan process.
That's what I was thinking, yeah.
So I had this, I'll backtrack to a little earlier in our conversation.
Okay, because I want to hear this one too.
Because I was at Paramount and I developed the show scan process, and I'm coming at it as a filmmaker and a director and a writer.
Yeah.
And we had this screening in Westwood in a theater we converted with a gigantic screen and a special projector. Charlie Bluedorn, who was the head of Gulf and Western that owned Paramount Pictures, was there with Barry Diller and Jeff Katzenberg and maybe a few others. I can't remember who all were there. But when the movie ended, Bluedorn jumped out of his seat, turned to the executives of Paramount, said, "Gentlemen, if we don't make a movie in this process, we're fools, because this is the future of cinema."
Right.
That was a big moment for me. I thought, aha, all my problems are solved. Now we're going to go off into the blue yonder and make wonderful movies.
Right.
Well, didn't happen for a lot of other reasons. I'm not going to burn up our time talking mm-hmm. about that. But that was back in the late 70s.
Okay.
Of doing 60 frame, 70 millimeter film. And at that same moment in time, Paramount got all embroiled in the making of Star Trek, the motion picture.
Okay.
Okay. And they said, "Doug, we're really in a pickle here. We're having trouble with the visual effects. This movie is not working. Mm-hmm. We really need some help." And they were kind of begging me to come in and help them fix Star Trek, the motion picture. Okay. Robert Wise was directing, and it had all the cast and Nimoy and Shatner and everybody. And I said, "No, I'm not here under contract to Paramount to supply visual effects services. I've kind of moved on. I'm a director, but I've also invented this process."
Right.
The bottom line was that Paramount decided that it was much more important to them to get Star Trek done successfully than to deal with show scan.
Okay.
This was a huge event for me.
Mm-hmm.
They said, "Doug, take your show scan thing. We're not going to do it. We're closing Future General down. We don't want to do it. We want to do Star Trek."
Okay.
So I was asked to go into a meeting with Barry Diller and don't know who else, Michael Eisner might have been there at the time, my lawyers, their lawyers, and they said, we are in such a pickle because this movie's production has been paid for by the exhibitors under a program called blind bidding, where they pay in advance for the rights to show a movie.
Hmm.
Okay. This is kind of the stories that very few people know about.
Yeah.
And so I'm there. And so what's blind bidding? I said, well, the movie has been paid for by others. And if we don't deliver the movie to them on December 7th of this coming year, they're going to file a class action lawsuit against Paramount Pictures and close us down.
Wow.
And close all our theaters, all the theaters booked for the movie for the Christmas holiday. They're going to just close the theaters.
Wow.
Because the movie they paid for is not there. And so that was just going to basically put Paramount Pictures out of business.
Wow.
And so I was told, said, well, we've got to get this movie done. We don't care what it costs. We don't care how long it takes, but we need your help getting the movie done. So I said, okay, I will set everything in my life aside and I'll go fix this movie for you.
Okay.
That was my job. And that was what happened, but it sprung Brainstorm and ShowScan free of Paramount.
Hmm.
They dropped the ball. So I was out looking for another studio to make Brainstorm, not at Paramount. And I don't know if you know about the whole scandal that went on during the years that David Beagleman was at Columbia Pictures.
Hmm.
Oh, this was really fun. I was working with Steven Spielberg at Columbia Pictures doing Close Encounters.
Right.
Under a subcontract to them that Paramount had agreed to. This was previous to the Star Trek problem, to do the visual effects for Close Encounters. So Richard Jurisich and I were doing the visual effects for Close Encounters. And that was all going just fine. I don't know what I'm trying to lead to with that is that Columbia got Close Encounters. David Beagleman was running Columbia.
Yeah.
David Beagleman embezzled a check sent to Cliff Robertson.
Okay.
Cliff Robertson found out about it, never got the money, and filed a lawsuit against Columbia Pictures for embezzling. It's a long story. But anyway, this whole story is told in a book by David McClintock called Indecent Exposure.
Okay.
This is an amazing story of behind-the-scenes Hollywood that you just won't read anywhere else.
Yeah.
Anyway, David Beagleman got in hot water. It was a huge scandal on Wall Street. Columbia Pictures was teetering on the verge of some kind of huge scandal that would adversely affect their stock. But at the same time, Close Encounters was just about to come out, and they all knew it was going to be a blockbuster.
Right.
They all knew that we had done this amazing thing. So Close Encounters came out. It was hugely successful, but David Beagleman got ousted from Columbia Pictures. The board of directors said, you are out here. We got to get you away because you're scandalizing our company.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know the details of how it happened. Anyway, David Beagleman, the embezzler, ended up at MGM, running MGM.
Right.
Calls me because I had saved his butt on Close Encounters.
Okay.
He said, well, do you have any movies that you'd like to make? And I said, yes, I happen to have this movie Brainstorm.
Right.
That got, you know, kicked out of Paramount Pictures. And so he was very interested in that because I had established a very high level of credibility with him at Columbia and made, I think I contributed a lot to the success of Close Encounters.
Oh, yeah.
With the mothership and the UFOs and all that stuff. So I got this deal to make Brainstorm at MGM. And when I got to this meeting at MGM about the process, the ShowScan process, they said, Doug, it's just too hard. Getting theaters to convert to a different kind of projector or a different kind of screen is just never going to happen. So we've just got to give up on that.
Hmm.
We just don't see it happening, and we're not going to do it. But whatever you want to do otherwise, let us know what it is. So I said, okay, I will find an alternative solution, which I think will be changing the aspect ratio and changing from monophonic sound to stereo sound and changing from 35 millimeter to 70 millimeter.
Okay.
It's going to be a variable aspect ratio movie.
No
frame rate stuff.
Right.
That's the way Brainstorm was made. And it's been a huge disappointment to me that it could have been a transformational movie for the movie industry to show how high frame rates could have really created a new sense of immersion and spectacle.
Yeah.
So that's kind of a long story, but anyhow, that's the story behind that.
I think it was really an amazing film. I know, obviously, that film had a lot of history and struggles in a lot of ways, and yep. But I still love it. I still love that you. Film, and
that's
I think
great.
The performances were really great. I think the idea, I mean, really, you were creating a film about VR long before any of that was around. And I think, you know, it was really kind of a thing that when I was a kid, I think the first time I actually saw it was on VHS tape, believe it or not. So it completely ruined everything, but
yeah.
I still loved it. And then I saw it more recently, obviously at a higher resolution and all of that. And it really just had that feeling of, when you go into that world, it may not be 60 frames a second, but you definitely see the resolution. You see the bigger picture, and you shot everything in these beautiful fisheye lenses. I don't know what kind of fisheye lenses those
were. Well, that was very similar to what Kubrick had done in 2001.
Right. Okay.
With fisheye lenses. That's really part of the equation.
Because fisheye lenses always tend to look so cheap sometimes, but they don't. If they're beautiful fisheye lenses, they're like really immersive, and they look fantastic.
Yeah.
So it was a really great thing, for sure. Now, I don't want to get too much into because I know we're running out of time, and I want to be worried about your time as well. But the when you came up to us, basically, we had this one short that we had created when I was working with Kevin Margo. We had created a teaser for Construct, and it was 1 minute. And you had found out through NVIDIA that we had done it basically, through these NVIDIA cards, and the rendering was very quick because of that. And so somehow we convinced NVIDIA to loan us a bunch of computers and to render the entire thing at 60 frames a second, 100 each eye, at 4K. So when we added up the number of pixels, how many more pixels we had to render compared to the original version, it was 40 times more. But when I saw it on that screen, I was really, really blown away. You're still showing that, am I correct?
Oh yeah, it's right here in this little theater behind me.
That's really awesome.
We show it quite often, and people are blown away every time.
Yeah.
Because it has this effect of taking what is really animation or performance capture and making it look like it's absolutely real.
Yeah.
They're real characters, and they're fully dimensional, and they're in the room with you. And it's a completely different immersive experience.
Yes.
So working with you guys on that, see, my take on that, and one of my objectives in doing that little experiment with you had a couple of particular ideas about it. One of them was that we were going to up-res an existing movie that you had already made.
Yep.
It was all baked in, all the depth of field, all the camera, the lens angles, and all that was baked into the movie. And I said, let's just take that as it is. I don't want to change anything. I'm not going to ask you to change the convergence or anything. Then just render it at 120 frames total, 4K.
Mm-hmm.
And it was lucky that, you know, John Eisen was there that day when we were at NAB.
Yep.
I don't know if he's still at NVIDIA, but they're a real leader in this world of image manipulation and stuff. So they wanted to test this graphics engine-based render farm, right?
Right.
So the idea that I was trying to pursue is that if you could take an existing animated film and it's done, and all you need to do is convert it to our process, which is nothing but machine time.
Yep.
No human time. No intervention by humans fixing things or doing anything. Take it exactly as it is and re-render it at a high frame rate. And it worked perfectly.
Yeah.
And that was a really good idea, and it really succeeded. And the results are stunning. And so that means that there's this whole market that we opened up at that time that you could take any animated film, whether it's Frozen or you name it, there's a million of really good animated films out there, and make them become much more powerful and much more real and much more compelling than they are in 2D or at 24 frames.
Well, I learned so much from it, because there were so many things that, you know, as I was like looking through every detail, because I remember specifically we're talking about the shutter angle and all of this stuff, and I remember what we're trying to do. So, for example, it's like, okay, so since the projector is going to project left eye, then right eye, left eye, right eye, left eye, right eye. We temporally offset it by one one-twentieth of a second so that whatever is being projected is temporally correct. We're not showing the same time at different times, right? We're showing the right time at the right time.
Right.
And the other thing that was also interesting is the motion blur, which is something, you know, again, we are used to seeing motion blur to see seem cinematic, right? But we did our motion blur physically correct as well, because what we did is the motion blur was a full frame of motion blur, so full 360, like the full exposure.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah. So that basically it's one one-twentieth of the time, so that it was as if the shutter was open for the whole time and then the next shutter. So you're basically getting, as you said, the shutter is open the whole time. It's going left eye, right eye, but it's open the whole time.
Yeah, and that's okay.
Yeah, and it looked, that's what made everything look so smooth. But smooth, there was something interesting was, I have been so used to not liking the 120 frame motion smoothing on TVs. When I suddenly see it this way, I'm like, what there's something we've been doing that's been wrong for so long. So it was really interesting to see that.
Well, I've been at this thing for an awfully long time, Chris, and it's just it's been very troubling to me that the movie industry has gone down this path of 24 frames with double shutters and blur and stuff for so many years, and it's become so habitual that it just doesn't want to change and doesn't want to learn anything and doesn't want to do anything differently. And it's been a really hard path for me. I mean, I live with a grim world of being rejected and misunderstood. And yet everyone who comes here and sees Construct or Ufotog or anything else, they're just utterly blown away.
Right.
They've never seen anything like it. And they say, wow, that looks like a movie. It tells a story. It's emotional. Everything you want it to be is there, but it doesn't have any bad artifacts or blurring or nasty stuff. And you can have tremendous high action.
Yeah.
And it's been a long haul for me. I'm still plugging away at it, even in spite of the fact that Gemini Man kind of distorted everyone's perception of what it could or should be. Because this is another little story I can tell you about working with, I guess it's Paramount who did Gemini Man.
Okay.
And I had to tell them, I said, listen, you guys, I know Ang Lee is basically derived what he's done based on my work. He's visited my studio 8 times.
Yeah.
He's had his cinematographers here, his editors here, his post-production team. Everybody's come to this studio to see this thing right behind me.
Right.
And they get blown away and they love it. And so I feel that I have been fair and honest with you guys. And I have patents on this.
On it.
And if you violate my patents on the release of this movie, there could be a problem. No, I don't know what that problem is, but it could be a problem. So we finally came to an agreement that I would take a screen credit on the movie.
Okay.
With me knowing full well that they probably wouldn't do it right, which they didn't.
Right.
They didn't. They still didn't understand it. And this has been a lesson to me. That even though you can get screen credit on a big movie like that, it doesn't make any difference. And it doesn't change the fact that in today's movie industry, see, you're in the animation industry.
Yeah.
And so when you come, like I did and like you have, you come at a movie one frame at a time, and then you animate it. That's where you understand what motion is all about and how movies work and everything. And then it starts becoming more and more sophisticated with really cool performance capture and smoothing and all the other things you can do to make movie magic and all the rendering amazing things you can do to make these characters look totally real, which is mind-boggling to me. So we're in this age where very few professional filmmakers or exhibitors or studio heads or directors or cinematographers understand how movies work.
Yeah.
They simply don't know. If you go to Chris Nolan or somebody and say, do you know that your movie's being shown, every frame is being shown 5 times? He probably doesn't know that.
Yeah.
Really nice guy, very astute. But most people don't understand how movies work. And they don't understand that this transition from celluloid to digital has brought with it some tricky problems.
Right.
that are easy to solve. I mean, they're brainlessly easy to solve. The Magi process is so elegantly simple to do and so inexpensive to do. And one of the things I wanted to ask you about that maybe you could comment on here, which is when you get into this world, which we're all in the movie industry, of computer-generated content, which means that there is a cost associated with every render of every frame.
Absolutely.
And an uninitiated person might look at, well, you mean I just, this movie is a 24 frame per second 2K render.
Yep.
And it's gonna take up our entire render farm for X months to do this. And I'm saying, well, but why don't you do it at 120 frames? And they say, well, that's whatever number you came up with, how many times, pixels, you know, 40 times more data. And they say, well, no way. We can't afford that. There's no way we could do that. I was on the set of Lion King recently.
Yeah.
When John and they were all dealing with rendering hair of the lion, you know.
Yeah.
And it was completely clogging up the entire Disney render farm.
Right.
And they said, well, we can't do more frames. This would just be impossible, completely impossible. Or 4K, that would be impossible as well.
Right.
So I'm saying, well, okay, maybe you think it's impossible, but I think what's where the money goes is in the human talent and the human effort and the human design and the human animation. And only part of the money goes into the render.
Right.
Maybe so. Maybe you have some comments on what that ratio is.
Well, there is way. Okay, so there is ways you can do this. Well, you are going to have to pay some way or another, right? And computer time is technically cheaper than artist time for sure. But artist time is also expensive when the artist is waiting for renders.
Yes.
So that's kind of an issue. But you can solve that by doing your rendering on the cloud. Because on the cloud, you just use more computers and less time.
Yes.
So then the artist is not necessarily waiting for frames. There's also a lot of data that has to be processed. That becomes a little bit more expensive as well. I believe that it is possible to do that 120 frames a second. I do believe that there's ideas to make that happen that I think are fundamentally right. But honestly speaking, and we only have a few minutes, unfortunately, but the other thing that is like people are not necessarily going to go to theaters that much. In fact, right now, I can't really go to a movie.
No, right.
So now what we have to do is we got to rely on our TVs to be our movie theaters. And our TVs are fairly capable of creating some pretty beautiful images.
They're pretty good. Amazing.
And you can do 120 hertz at least on a TV, technically speaking.
Yes.
So I'm actually curious, do you think that maybe that's the way we can do it because people technically have the ability to do it in their home?
I think this is really fundamentally salient to what I'm working on right now.
Yeah.
Because you want to make a movie that's compatible with theaters and televisions.
Yes.
And we're in this weird moment because of the virus and everything. Everybody's at home streaming every movie they can possibly see. And television is really quite extraordinarily good, particularly when it's 4K.
Yeah.
And if we can get the industry to understand that this shuttering issue is vitally important to up-resing or interpolating, you've got to be very careful that you're not aware of that. You can't just take any 24 frame movie and make it 120 or 240.
Right.
It will look like a soap opera.
Yeah.
That can be fixed. That's all fixable. So if we can get over that hurdle, I think we can make big inroads into the home TV business. There's another thing happening, which is if you look at these monster TVs that are being built for 8K television,
yep.
Are you ready for your 8K render, Chris?
Nope, that's you're just adding four times more render just by the
yeah, exactly. So anyway, these are humongous TVs.
Yeah.
And the bandwidth to enable 8K is going to be a lot.
Yeah.
And so I think if you say, well, let's take this bandwidth and let's just use it differently to do two 4K 60 frame image streams.
Right.
Instead of one 8K 60 image stream. It's about the same amount of data.
Yeah.
And we're working with a company that's doing some really amazing compression algorithms.
Oh, nice.
Can get the data rate down and it still looks absolutely unperturbed.
Yeah, I think that's going to be the key is compression.
Yeah, it's going to be compression, yeah. So I think there's a lot of you know, reason for optimism.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not against television at all. I think it's an amazing thing. But one thing you have to also understand when you talk about frame rates or immersion,
yeah,
or making what I call cinematic spectacle,
yeah,
is you want a very wide field of view, like Cinerama was, or like D150 was, or Todd Ale was.
Okay.
It's a very wide field of view, which means if you have an 8K or a 4K TV and you make a movie that's really designed to optimize that, you really should sit a little closer to your TV.
Right.
You know, and be in the movie. It'll be much more powerful.
Right.
And one of the things they found in SMPTE studies, yeah, is that when people buy a 4K TV, which is bigger than their 2K TV, they sit farther away.
That's weird.
They just can't naturally gravitate to the seeing a movie that's far enough away from them so they don't get taken over by it.
Right. Interesting.
I don't know what to do with that, but I think that the home theater is going to start transforming and be really pretty good. And we know we can do our Magi process digitally and transmit it with reasonable bandwidth.
Okay, hopefully you guys enjoyed that part of that podcast with Doug Trumbull, who's absolutely amazing, and I have been really pleasured that I got to know him. Unfortunately, as I mentioned, he passed away in 2022, which is very, very sad. But hopefully you guys enjoyed that. If you want to hear the full podcast, just go to episode number 284, and you guys can hear the whole thing the podcast in its entirety. But for now, we'll move on to the next one with Tim Miller and Joe Kaczynski from December 2016.
So, Tim, I want to actually ask you a couple questions. I want to sort of jump on a little bit.
Okay.
Last time we talked, you were in the middle of post-production on Deadpool, right?
Yes.
And you didn't... There was still a little bit of that shock that came from Comic-Con that, oh, my God, people may actually like this movie, right?
Yeah.
You didn't really know if people
were like, my career's not over.
Yeah. Something like that, right?
Before it even started.
Yeah. And enough that you, of course, the creative juices are going. It's like, I want to do a really great title sequence, right?
Yes.
And you wanted to do the title sequence that we were looking at earlier. And if you guys haven't seen those who are streaming, you should... Look up the title sequence of the Deadpool, or if you haven't seen it, go see the whole movie, but it's an amazing one. What was funny is I saw yesterday, there's a video I was talking about, like, some of the best title sequences out there, and interestingly, that one came up as one of them, because it really kind of sets the tone. And what it's really funny about it is it doesn't actually have anyone's names in there.
Yeah.
Which is risky for a title sequence.
I guess, yeah. I mean, but it wasn't a title sequence.
It wasn't really a joke. It was a joke.
Yeah.
But like I was saying, you know, before we started on the live stream, it's like I showed this to my wife. It's like, we're going to watch Deadpool. She goes, all right, I'll watch Deadpool with you. And she saw the title sequence. It's like, oh, I'm 100% invested. I mean, this movie is making fun of itself from the beginning, right? It just knows that humor. And that was also like the thing is like, You are going to go see a very violent movie that's constantly joking around and is doing a bunch of stuff. And this is stuff that you had to prove to people that this was going to be possible. That people wanted to see this. And now Deadpool is, what, the number one most successful R-rated movie of all time? Is that correct?
I think so, unless that Jesus movie... another girl.
Oh, gosh, Jesus. Right.
That might have been like worldwide. Yeah, yeah. Jesus beat me. That's okay.
Okay. All right. It's between, you know.
Second to Jesus.
Jesus and Deadpool.
Deadpool and Jesus. I like that.
Yeah, basically what Jesus. Say.
I'll take it. Yeah. But I mean, and I think you proved to people that people may want to see things that are not necessarily, you know, PG or PG-13.
Just first, I would say that that title sequence was, I would like to say, yeah, I conceived of it because I'm a genius, but one of the animatics, one of our artists, who's now our director, Frank Balson, we hadn't cast the movie yet, so he was working on previs for the title sequence because we always knew it was going to be this frozen moment, and so it was Ryan Reynolds, and then we hadn't cast anybody else, so it was... The hot chick, the cool teen, the, you know, the CGI character.
Right.
And he just put him in there as placeholders. And we thought it was funny. So we decided to, like, keep that joke through there and make it sort of a generic statement on the generic nature of superhero
right,
movies.
Right.
Can I just say, since we're televised now, because I haven't talked since Deadpool 2, I stepped off the movie.
Yeah.
I just want to say one thing to our geek audience out there, because it's important to me what sure. the geeks and nerds of the world thinks, because they are my brothers and sisters. I didn't want to make some stylized movie that was three times the budget. And this, if you read the internet, who cares really? But for those of you who do, I wanted to make the same kind of movie that we made before, because I think that's the right movie to make for the character. And so don't believe what you read on the internet. I wanted to do the same thing. Kyle Chandler was not going to be Cable. All this stuff that I read kind of kills me. Even when some people go, the movie was really hard to make, the movie was a joy to make. I think you see it on screen. Yeah. We all had such a good time, you know, had a little few arguments in post, but nothing more than usual. Anyway, I just wanted to, I hate people, like the crew was so great. Everybody was going to come back and we were going to have such a good time. And the idea that it was a difficult movie, it wasn't. It was a joy, and it was the best experience of my life. So.
Well, we're in the age of technology. Thanks for sharing that, Sam. I mean, I think we're also in the age where of fake news a little bit. So we have to see.
Yeah,
that.
I mean, but, shit goes spreads.
Yeah, and people. When I was reading it, it's like, this does not sound anything like what Ting was explaining to me, which is fine. And I think obviously people have creative differences. And that should not necessarily be dismissed as, hey, does a creative differences is fine, but it didn't sound like you. I just didn't think Tim Miller wants to actually make a gigantic over pot. Doesn't make any sense.
No, I didn't.
But it's fine. I think, I think Ryan is dedicated to the project that he's doing, and I think Deadpool 2 is going to have a direction that's going to be in it. That's going to be great. I don't think this necessarily means you stepping off the project means it's going to be a better or worse.
Of course it does. No, I'm just kidding. No.
So it's just going to be a different movie.
I wish them nothing but good. I hope it's great. I wish it was a great movie.
Okay.
Because I love the character, and I think it's great, and I love all the actors, and I want to see them successful again. And, apparently I haven't met David, but he's a great guy from everything I've heard.
Sure.
I want nothing but the best for the character. And for Fox, too, you know.
Yeah.
They deserve to make more money. They need to make more money. They were great. They were terrific, so.
You were a Deadpool fan. You've been a Deadpool fan for a while then, and you just realized, like, this was a property that I really, really want to.
Yeah,
really want to do this movie.
If you see, maybe you can see it in the V-Ray video, but there's a wall at Blur, there's a two-story wall of books. Half of it, the top half, is comics, because I've been reading comics since I was 12.
So did you pick
12?
Like, some of the characters, I like X-Men a lot, and I didn't know what teenage wardrobe bomb
Nobody
woman.
Knew.
Fastball.
Negasonic teenage warhead.
Yeah. The angry teen. There's like some of these people, like they're like the X-Men people. Like, I don't quite know. They weren't the.
We were looking for new characters to add, and I would look through this big list that Fox has, and there were three. I had a bunch that I wanted to use, like Cannonball, all these visually spectacular characters, and I was making a list for the writers to have a conversation about what we use. And at the bottom, I said, I can't believe these are actually characters. How goofy is this? One of them was Negasonic Teenage Warhead.
Yeah.
The other one was Tar Baby. And I'm sorry, I know it sounds racist, but that's why I was like, holy fucking shit. This is how could this be a Tar Baby? And Harry Ocelot was another book. And so the writers looked at this list and said, and all the cool ones that I had identified that I wanted to use, and said, no way, man, we're using Negasonic Teenage Warhead. That's fucking awesome. Which is what they did. How she got in there.
What was Stan Lee's response when you asked him to DJ a strip club?
All right. Okay, sure. Yeah, Stan was like, I mean, we gave him a list of really foul things to say. And he wouldn't see, because we went and got the guy who actually announces the women coming onto stage. And for those of you who don't frequent strip clubs, it can be, fairly misogynistic. And to his credit, Stan would not say any of those things.
Yeah.
Not that I tried to. They were just options. They were just it wasn't that I wanted. just B-roll. But.
One thing I love so much about Deadpool is the violence. It reminds me of It reminds me of Evil Dead 2, the level of violence. There's this humor associated with it. I don't know if you know Evil Dead 2, but it's like this slapstick violence where it's funny and then you feel bad because you realize what you just laughed at is a guy being smashed to smithereens against a sign on a freeway or anything like that. Like,
yeah.
Did you go into it like what you wanted to do in terms of level of violence and knowing that this is going to be rated R, but we're going to do it in a cartoony way?
You know, I'm not a big fan of violence, oddly enough. You know, I didn't want to do any like swords slicing people in half in front of the character and guts sliding out or any of that. It just doesn't, I just don't find it interesting. In fact, when we were working on Deadpool 2 for this next version, the stunt guy, stunt coordinator Phil Silvera was going, man, let's really like open it up this time. And I'm like, no, stop. We don't. Because here was my theory on this, and it's partially taste, but also a commercial consideration, is I feel like there are people that like that extreme violence. I'm not one of them. But those people are going to come see Deadpool anyway because it's a genre film, right? And so if I made it more violent, they may like it a little bit more. But all these other people, which is probably 90% of the audience, would not. And I don't think this is a gender-based issue, but when you test the movie, I could literally see it in the cards where we had more violence in the cuts. You see the scores go down with women. You see the scores go down with other sections of the audience too. And so the point is why would you lose those people? Why would you make them enjoy the film less so that you could get a little more shooting, blood, and gore? I just didn't think it was a smart decision, and I didn't think it was a good creative decision.
So you made adjustments based on your testing to the violence?
Yes. Sort of. Like, there's the, if you've seen the film, there's a big torture sequence in the middle.
Yeah.
Yes. And you found out that the longer that sequence was, there was a longer cut of that, the harder it was for people to laugh. Like, the bar scene on the end of the torture scene sequence is one of the funniest scenes in the movie. And people weren't laughing when we had a longer
because
cut.
Because
it's still affected by the other part.
Yeah, yeah, they'd spent so long in the darkness, it was really hard for them to laugh.
How many test rounds did you go through?
We did four. Wow. One, the first one was friends and family, and uh-huh. then four screens on the lot, which was fucking great. I don't know why directors don't like it, but basically people come in and tell you what's wrong with your movie.
Yeah,
right.
And you did them on the lot at Fox. You didn't travel for them.
And is it just people that work at Fox that come to see it, or...?
No, they go and they don't tell people what they're going to see.
Right.
They just go and say, do you like these types of films that are, you know, the type of film that Deadpool, so it's generally genre. Do you like Gladiator? Do you like Star Wars? Mm-hmm. Come see this film. And they do. And what's really cool is you're in the audience when they announce. I mean, you probably do this. You're like, tonight you're going to be one of the first to see Deadpool or Tron. And people go, ooh, shit. Like, and then you feel really good because, you know, people are excited about
yeah.
it.
Yeah. So, that's cool.
But you can literally see. And then we filmed the audience, too.
Right.
Watching the movie.
Oh, really?
Yeah, so you can see. And it was great because you'd get in an argument about, like, with Ryan and the writers, like, oh, that was funny, or which joke's funnier. And I would go, look at the audience.
Let's go to the tape.
Look, they're not laughing, so, you know.
That's a great idea.
Or, and sometimes I would be wrong, and I would go, man, that fucking killed that joke. And then you'd see the tape, and everybody's like...
Yeah.
And then it was terrible because in one important screening for the executives, when the executives see this take too, there was one guy prominent, like right in the front row, and he's like this. The entire movie.
Wow.
And it turns out that he was the guy that like set up the tape recorder, and he'd been up all night for some reason. Problem. Uh-huh. But you know, you can't tell the executives that, so all they see is this guy that, you know, apparently put into a coma by your film.
Right. Did you do any test screenings on stuff?
On Tron, we did. Well, Tron was tricky because our main character, Clue, was a guy in a head sock.
Right,
up until the end.
Yeah.
So that's a hard movie to test. That's right, you were there. So we did do one test screening, which was really nerve-wracking for me, which is we went and tested it at Pixar.
Oh, right.
Oh, that'd be cool.
Yeah. So we went up to Pixar and tested
the brain trust.
Yeah. And the brain trust.
Really?
Yeah, the whole brain trust,
man,
saw it. So
that
it was, me and the brain trust. And yeah, it was great. Learned a lot of great things. And but, you know, it was interesting. They didn't like a lot of things that I love about the movie. Like, some of them hated the score, you know. Mm-hmm. So you have to take, you know, you got to take it. Take some notes, reject others. But it was overall, it was a really great experience and amazing too. That's where I met like Michael Arndt and Brad Bird and Pete Docter and all those guys. So it was
I remember
amazing.
When that screening took place, you were like, all right.
Yeah, it was like I feel like it was in April or something. It must have been 8 months out. So it must have, I can't imagine what that cut
we
looked
were
like.
Getting it a bunch of stuff like we got to get these shots final for Joe so he can take it to that.
Previs and a guy with a head sock. Yeah.
Yep. How did you get on Tron? How did, because I've heard about, like, you've
done stole this Halo commercial. And
was Blur going to do Tron?
Wow.
Sorry.
Yeah, they love my Halo commercial.
It's kind of a, it's
which
such
brought
an amazing
him to the attention of Hollywood.
Let's see. Sorry. Tron. Tron was started with, you know, when you first come to L.A. and you want to be a director, you end up doing what they call the water bottle tour.
Oh, yeah. We talk about, go back to listen to the Wes Ball podcast. He talks about taking the
So you go around, you meet a bunch of executives and producers and writers around town. And one of the people I met was a guy by the name of Sean Bailey, who was a producer.
Who did you say, Sean?
Sean Bailey, who's now the president of production at Disney.
Yeah.
Met him, and he said that Disney was trying to figure out Tron. And they've been trying, I think, for years.
Yeah.
And this is in 2008, I want to say, 2007. And just was wondering, like, what my, if I had any interest. And I actually hadn't seen it in a long time. I just had remembered my impressions of seeing it as a, what would have been, 7 years old, 8 years old.
Yeah.
And he kind of pitched me things they were talking about, which was in the realm of, I would say the Matrix. It was like the internet, and like there were different lands that were different websites. So you could go to Google Land or Yahoo Land or whatever the websites were at the time. And there was one was like Egypt, and one was a jungle, and one was underwater. And there was like all these connected worlds. And I just said, you know, for me, the memory of Tron is so distinct. I'm much more interested in the idea that it's the world has been sealed and the internet doesn't exist to it. It's this kind of ecosystem that's evolved for 30 years on its own.
On its own, yeah.
And what would that feel like? Like if you took the world of the 1982 world of Tron and let it evolve over 30 years to become this kind of photoreal landscape, it still felt like the 80s. What would that be like? And he was, I think he liked that idea. And I said, you know, rather than talk about it, I feel like it's something you need to see. How about I do a little test like you did? Why don't we do 2 minutes of it and see, so I can, you know, show you what it would feel like and maybe hint at this narrative, which was this kind of Joseph Conrad, you know, Hearts of Darkness kind of journey to find this person who had been lost down the river. So Disney gave me some money to do a teaser, like you did.
I saw yours. It was beautiful.
Oh, thanks.
Yeah.
Did you come over to DD? Is that where you saw it?
I don't know where I saw it. Somebody had it and showed, that shouldn't have had it and showed.
I'm sure. I'm sure. But we did it with like a 12-man team. I don't know if you were a DD then.
No, I wasn't a DD, but I remember the guys who worked on it.
Yeah, it was like 12 guys, and it was like 6 months.
Yep.
And I convinced Jeff Bridges to be in it somehow. And we made this little 2-minute short and showed it to Disney. And Sean and I showed it to Disney, and we convinced them to test it at Comic-Con just to see, you know, if the fans would be interested in something like that.
And we were.
And they were. Yeah, it turns out they were.
They would never do that today.
No, because there was no script. There was, it was literally a 2-minute or 2 or 3 minute test video, proof of concept.
Right.
And they showed it at Comic-Con, and I remember being in the room, and I thought the response was good, but I don't remember it being like I wasn't sure. And then someone had recorded it on their cell phone from like the back, from the audience. Cause I was up in the front with like the Disney executives, which is like the least fun place to be for watching it.
Yeah.
And someone recorded it from like the back row with the fans. And then I think that's what leaked online. And then you heard people do, you know, Tron, is this Tron? You know, cause they, you could hear like the whispers in the crowd.
Well, cause Tron was one of those, it wasn't a huge box office thing, but it was had such a cult.
Oh, it's kind of a cult.
And it's definitely cult.
It's one of the most stylized, it's like almost like design, like just beautiful design. It's so immediately recognizable, the original one, and still it is. And one thing that's really impressed with what you did with it is you maintained it, but you updated it. But at the same time, you're right, it still is 80s. It still is... You're able
that's
to
why Joe is
that.
So perfect for that movie because his aesthetic is so clean. And
so does the architecture come into that in your background?
Oh, for sure. I mean, that movie is all about world creation. I mean, if you're not a if you don't have a design background, I don't know how you do a movie like that. Because there's so many decisions to make, and you have to love it because there was so much building to do.
Because it was so CG, it was such a joy to work with someone who understood the challenges we were dealing with, right? As example, I was working on the light bike sequence. That was one of the things that I was in charge of, right? And the light bike sequence, as you know, was multi-level this time as opposed to a single one in the first movie. And we were examining, like, what would it be like to actually make all the glass look correctly? We were all reflecting back and forth. And it turned into freaking Pee-wee's Funhouse really quickly because it was way too many ray trace reflections. And so you and I was like, no, we got to cut that down because you can't see what's going on anymore.
Right.
So you understood the problem. It wasn't like I had to convince you. And you because you have a CG background, you understood what the challenges were.
Yeah, it was a great first film to work on because there was certainly a lot of stuff I was comfortable with diving in on that. But that was all V-Ray, right? We end up switching halfway through.
There was Eric Barba had been using V-Ray for a while, and I guess he started in Mental Ray.
It was like in the commercial side, right?
And he started using it in Mental Ray, and then there was, not that I want to plug or whatever, but we were, the big challenge, the big thing that drove the decision was that Mental Ray at the time could not do proper 3D motion blur very well.
Okay.
And when you have, just as a technical thing, but if you have a bike, like a light cycle, traveling at 100 miles an hour on a piece of glass, if you do 2D motion blur, where you do it in post, then the reflection is going to blur, and it needs to reflect and not blur. The glass needs to blur.
But that's what it couldn't.
So it has to, and so V-Ray could do that much faster, and there was a lot of very shiny surfaces that need to look correct.
Do you remember the light cycle arena I had built up in my office, the big white foam core?
Yeah.
I mean, it'd be funny. I could dig it up, or I don't know if we put it on the Blu-ray, but like all those sequences were built with models and little guys on sticks, and I was shooting.
Really?
It was all previs. It was previs by hand.
Yeah.
I had to figure it out.
I remember
particularly the light cycle because it was three-dimensional chess, essentially.
Yeah.
It was a very
and it would change
difficult
shapes.
Thing. Yeah. Things would change different things.
Yeah, and David Levy, who was working on designing it with it, and he actually ended up sitting right next to me so that we could look at it together and see how it was going
to
work.
Oh, that's cool. So an artist next to
a concept
a 2D artist
next to next to a post-production.
3D artist.
Yeah. It was really useful to have that.
Why didn't you do it with regular previews? Why did you do it with models? Just faster?
Started with models just because I needed that kind of three-dimensional spatial understanding as a first step, and then started breaking into shots and previewing the whole thing. But that and the disc game, which was also complicated, it was just better to have a model and figure it out, you know, by hand.
Yeah. We did a lot of stunt sequences with little men. And
yeah. It's like car chases, you know, or anything. Yeah.
You have to do the sound effects.
Yeah, you can't.
It's the fastest way to communicate. I mean, like you said, a couple people sitting around a table, you can orchestrate something much quicker.
That makes sense.
Yeah,
absolutely. Sure. And then I worked on Oblivion with you, too.
That's right, of course.
Yeah. So that was... It was interesting about Oblivion was that it was so pretty. So pretty.
And I guess you shot everything on the
F-65. F-65,
yeah, yep. Which was such a good camera in terms of...
And still, the movie I just shot, we shot on the F-65. I mean, I was looking, the date stamps on the camera are December 2011. It's right. 5 years later, and still the camera of choice, at least for the project we were working on. The cameras aren't... You know, there was a while where every year a new camera was coming out,
right.
And now it's kind of plateaued off a little bit.
Well, it was so sharp and so good in low light that it was actually, like I was talking to the 2D super, and goes, you're really just going to have to up your game in terms of your noise threshold
right.
on your renderers, because they have to go all the way to like 13 or 20 stops of grain-free image.
It's very clean. And we couldn't have actually physically made that movie without that camera because of the light levels we were shooting in the Sky Tower.
Yeah. Yeah. And I kind of liked it. And I actually loved, that was the first time I met Tom Cruise, because we were doing some DigiDouble stuff with him as well. And he was, what I loved about him is because we were doing some really technical stuff, is he's a movie geek.
Oh, yeah.
He loves technology. He was asking us so many questions about how we're doing things. I was really kind of surprised. I expected him to come in, do his little shoot, et cetera. No, he just kept sticking around. Like, so how do you do this?
Tom came down to Blur one time.
Yeah.
To meet Fincher, and I were trying to do this heavy metal film, and Tom was going to help do it through MGM. So he came down, and he brought a producer with him, Mary Parent, and we met, and after an hour... Fincher goes, yeah, I got some shit to do. I got to go. And so David leaves, and then another hour, and we're still talking. Tom's with him. And Mary Parent goes, yeah, I got some shit to do. And Tom's like, I want to see some more stuff, man. Show me everything.
Yeah.
And then he stayed for 6 hours hung around Blur. And after like 3 hours, you forget that it's Tom Cruise.
Right. Right.
And so he's sitting at me, next to me by my desk, and I'm showing stuff on my computer. And I would, every once in a while, I would look over and go, hey, that's Tom Cruise.
Not out loud, I hope.
And then one of our artists, one of our animation supervisors, is an actor, and he really wanted to meet Tom. And I said, no, you can't. We're not doing that thing, you know. And so Tom excuses himself to go to the bathroom at one point. And I see this guy like make a beeline, follow him in the bathroom just so he could pee next to him and go, hey, how's it going? How you doing? It's an awkward meeting you here, but I'm a big fan. You know? But he was so great, so fucking like on point, interested, focused, present. It's amazing.
Well, we did all these things. We were shooting him, and I said, okay, because we have to shoot all these different expressions for the DigiDouble stuff. And he's like, all right, give me neutral. And he's like, perfect. Like the most neutral expression possible. And every time we asked him, he was like a robot. I mean, and I mean that in a good way. Like he would just repeat things over and over again. So he was really, I mean, he's a professional.
He's amazing.
He's made a lot of movies with the biggest directors in the world, including, you know, you.
Amazing to work with, yeah. It was an amazing experience to work with him. I highly recommend doing a movie with him.
Maybe he'll deign to do. Edge of Tomorrow was one of my favorite movies.
It's awesome.
Oh, my God. That movie's so fun. I did not expect to be so laugh so much in that movie because it was really, really funny.
Yeah,
But, you know, having gone, I've done a lot of meetings with David Fincher trying to sell movie different projects. And, you know, David's the big dog in the room, which is the way it should be. So you get used to everybody talking to David, and which is great for me because I could watch the interaction, learning the ropes, literally fucking 100 meetings. But Tom was like, Tim, what do you think? And I was like, me? You know, and it's just this really like, oh my God, I matter. And it really, it's like a powerful thing. I mean, celebrity, you shouldn't. Everybody puts their pants on one leg at a time.
Sure.
You shouldn't be overawed by that, but it's Tom fucking Cruise, and it's kind of giddy.
Yeah.
I felt like the first couple times I met Ryan, it's like, oh my gosh, Ryan Reynolds.
Right.
I got over it.